Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. With the expansion of the show's production every week, we want to start experimenting with new formats. So today's episode is much less of an interview and is much more of a conversation. I'm speaking with my good friend, Jason Willick. He is a columnist at the Washington Post. He's done some recent center-right writing on the Mar-a-Lago raid / search, depending on your political perspective as we get in during the episode. We also discuss the broader democracy under threat discourse, January 6th, the Electoral Count Reform Act discourse, all of those very controversial but deeply important bits. This is going to be a great episode that will definitely polarize people, so would love to hear what you think. Check out the Substack to reply or add any comments. Also, I'll add, this episode is brought to you by our Supercast subscribers. So if you enjoyed this conversation, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. Not only will you get bonus features, bonus episodes, bonus content, but you actually help support our show's mission and expand and take us to the point where we can do this completely independently. The way I want to do this is only subscribe if we put together a piece of content that particularly speaks to you and you find enjoyable. All that said, thank you to Lincoln Network, our sponsor, and hope you enjoy this conversation. It's great to have you here, Jason, and just go through a couple of newsy items that we'll be focusing on here on a deeper level on the show. How you doing?
Good. Longtime listener. So glad to be here.
Longtime listener, first time caller, having asked you on the show. Let's just start with the most obvious bit. Obviously, we've focused a lot on democracy on the show past year or so. Everything from gerrymandering, primaries, the discussion over whether January 6th represents a point of no return for the country, health of democracy, all those bits. You're obviously at the Washington Post, where the actual editorial tagline is "Democracy dies in darkness." You're also coming at this topic, though, from a center-right perspective. And you and I were discussing before the episode whether or not someone talks about democracy, capital D democracy, in their bio, in the books they're writing, the podcast they cover. It's usually a pretty decent signaler of their ideological perspective. So I'd love to hear how you think of big D democracy discourse in the United States right now and where you come down on it.
Well, an interesting thing is, I think everything you said is right, but I think it outside of Washington and New York, it doesn't apply. And the way you can tell is there's sometimes these polling questions where people ask which party is better for democracy or which party is a greater threat to democracy. And like, I think Republicans have a slight edge on this, or it's often 50-50. So people who pollsters talk to aren't getting the message that this is a coded partisan word in DC, that when we say democracy, we mean Democrats, we mean because people, when they think about democracy, they're not clued into that whole discourse. So I think, democracy, you're right that it's become a partisan term. There was sort of a threat to democracy discourse starting around Trump and Brexit. And I think it comes from something real, which is that, right-wing populism in particular has a certain kind of, as they say, disdain for political norms. These politicians are acting in a different way, and these European right-wing parties. I think the democracy element of it, though, is just never well defined, because democracy on its face means the majority rules, but then quite a lot of the time, populists are representing the more popular position, and the people who say that they're on the side of capital D democracy want to overrule that using counter-majoritarian institutions. Sometimes the populists want to use counter-majoritarian institutions. So I think, people want to give substance to democracy, which is really just a process, and they tend to want to mean something that arrives at certain progressive outcomes. We've heard, right, when we hear a candidate, if they win, is a threat to democracy. Well, they're winning an election, or Brexit is a threat to democracy. This is done by a referendum. The parliament might oppose it, and the parliament, it's not as majoritarian, as not as straightforwardly. It's not a plebiscite. It's channeling the view of the people through representatives. So it's, you know, it's unfortunate, I think, that the term has come to be this partisan, this sort of partisan code.
I guess the question for you then would be, how would you define democracy then? And what, given that definition, would you say are threats to democracy in the country right now, if there are any you see?
Well, let's see. I mean, I don't like the term democracy. I prefer, when I can, to use the term representative government, which is, you know, which is government that roots its sovereignty in the people in some way. That doesn't mean, though, that the majority always rules. You know, we have a constitutional democracy, which puts a lot of guardrails on the majority. So I like to say, you know, constitutional government or representative government, because nobody wants a pure democracy. I mean, the latest example, right, is Roe versus Wade being overturned was a threat to democracy when it's in fact making the issue, you know, decided in a more democratic way. Maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad. Not all issues should be decided in a democratic way, but that's just clearly an abuse of the term if you were to say that. So for me, yeah, I think more about what is a political system that can be legitimate, that people feel is legitimate, that is rooted, you know, in the sovereignty of the people ultimately, but that is not, but that doesn't necessarily bear a strong correlation to what is called capital D democracy. I'm more interested in creating, you know, a government that that is legitimate, that is that derives its legitimacy, you know, not from a monarch or not from a church, but ultimately derives its legitimacy from the people, and that works for them to govern effectively. So to me, you know, the threats to that are many in the United States, but it's not. I don't think the term is that helpful.
Okay, that's interesting. I want to focus on the words you're using here, because as a podcaster, I'm very precise with words. You referred to creating a form of government that is effective, representational, those different bits. Do you see a gap between the status quo and what you're describing here as your ideal state?
Certainly. I mean, look, I think, you know, and Gordon Wood has basically argued, I mean, I guess I kind of identify with the Federalists, right? In the founding era, the Federalists, they wanted to create a strong constitution that protected rights. They wanted to create a central government that would cohere, and they wanted, you know, the people to be, you know, and they wanted a constitutional and in some ways democratic government. So I think, but, you know, I think from the very beginning, if you read Gordon Wood, you know, this was, they were kind of swept away, and the sort of more democratic currents and the more anti-federalist and ultimately Jacksonian currents won out in the early republic. It was not going to be this federalist classical sort of constitutional system. It was going to be more of a 19th century democratic state. And that's fine. And I just think I'm generally on the side, you know, I think that the Federalists versus the anti-Federalists ideological orientation is still instructive today, because we sort of have anti-Federalists and Federalists today, but it doesn't match onto the partisan divide perfectly. We have, you know, populists on the right, I would say, are on, more on the anti-Federalist side, and also on the left. So I think we're often have this idea that the more perfect the alignment is between the popular will and governing policy, that the better it is, that everything should be a plebiscite. Everything should be decided by plebiscite. Everything should be decided by polling. And I just think that that is not how American institutions are designed to work, and not, you know, and do not, does not always conduce to deliberative and the best government. So I'm just, you know, to some extent, you know, poking some holes in this view of democracy that I think is not so informative.
I'm curious then, what do you think about populism then, right? So capital P populism in this case, because when you're talking about our government wasn't meant to be centered around polls, it's not meant to be perfectly responsive. So much of, let's just say, like the first level deep populist critique left and right of, like, let's say the United States specifically, has really said that the gap between what you're describing is not what we're being designed for and what we're actually seeing is like the central issue. So what do you think about like the broad populist critique of the status quo?
Well, I think it's very powerful. And I think, you know, I guess a conservative like me or somebody who thinks, you know, that there was a lot of good points that the Federalists made in the 18th century is, you know, populism happens when the institutions aren't working well and when good governance is not being delivered. And I think, you know, I go back and forth on to what extent populism is really because our institutions are working less well than they used to, and to what extent it's just because their flaws are more visible than they used to be. But I think in its best sense, you know, populism in the American tradition, and, you know, Trump is a rare example of a populist actually taking over, but I think in its best tradition, often the populists, you know, as Richard Hofstadter said, in third parties sting and then they die. In other words, they send the major parties, they point, look here, you know, immigration, this is not being addressed. And the major party moves in that direction and absorbs the populace. So I'm certainly not against populism. I think it's a, you know, I'm one of those people who thinks it's more of a symptom of failed governance than, you know, a threat per se, which I think is a little bit silly.
Speaking of Trump, let's get to the Mar-a-Lago issue, which is obviously, sorry, my light fell. Let's get to the Mar-a-Lago issue. You wrote a really good op-ed on this topic, which I think whether or not someone agrees with you is going to provide a good window to how to actually think through these sets of issues. So let's just start with your prediction that you made towards the start of the piece. What did you predict would come out of further revelations about the raid, the nature of it, what was found, like those different bits? Like, what's the reality you predicted?
Yeah, well, I predicted that no matter what comes out, there's going to be no, it's not like we're going to find out whether this raid was good or bad. It's a sort of a quaint notion, you know, from a pre-internet age and pre-Trump age that somebody imagines, well, this happened and then, you know, the scandal happened, then we're going to decide, we're going to find out what there is to it. There's going to be sort of a popular verdict delivered, you know, Nixon, okay, he's got to go. Enough Republicans agree. It's just not going to happen that way. That's not how it's ever happened with Trump. With Russiagate, people said, you know, all the time, well, these are the scenarios that there might be. There might be that there's this much collusion or that much collusion or no collusion or, you know, and then, you know, nobody has changed their minds on this. Nobody has really walked back their claims. The claims were largely wrong. I mean, there was some sketchy stuff going on in Trump's circle, unrelated to Russia, largely that Mueller was able to indict people for. But so, you know, we didn't get a verdict on Russiagate ever. It looked like we might get a verdict on January 6th. You know, the other biggest Trump scandal, it looked in the immediate aftermath like we might get a verdict. And look where we are now. We're still, the candidates are all litigating January 6th in the midterms. And you know, the goalposts just move. Well, okay, what Trump did was bad, but he shouldn't be impeached, or there shouldn't be a criminal investigation, or you know, the FBI, you know, needs to answer about what it knew and when. So I think it's going to be the same thing with the search, which is, you know, apparently about classified records. I think everyone's, I thought that when I saw people say, well, let's wait and see what there is, and then we'll be able to know. I mean, that makes sense for people to wait for information, and I'm waiting for information for them to make their own judgment. I just think that it's a little naive, almost, you know, and quaint to assume that that's going to answer, you know, give a political answer and break people out of their sides. Cause I think the liberals are going to say that the raid was justified no matter what, and Trump could be doing it, and even if nothing is found, and conservatives, the contrary. So that was my prediction.
Here's what I'm curious about, especially with the pre-internet bit, the quaint bit, we're not going to have another Watergate scandal type bit here. Do you think there's a, is it possible there's like an upper limit Is there something that could be done that would be so bad that it would break through the dynamic you're describing? Some would say last year at January 6th would have been that issue. And it definitely was for some Republicans, right? Like that was like the breaking point for Liz Cheney. That was the decision point for people, like, let's say, plenty of Republicans who are sort of more to the center on those issues. But what do you think is the upper limit on what can break through?
Well, I think Trump, one reason he's so effective is he's carefully calibrated to never really exceed that upper limit. I'm sure there is an upper limit, even on January 6th, you know, if he had actively, ordered Pence arrested by the Secret Service and, you know, done something like that, but he didn't do that. And he kind of has a sense of what the upper limit is. So I think that's part of his power, is to be able to skirt that. So you get polarization and recriminations. You don't get any conclusive outcome. But I do think, yes, I think there ultimately is some upper limit. I think Trump is probably has not exceeded it.
Man, what I like about what you just said is it captures something that I kind of have intuited, but I didn't quite know for sure, which is that Trump's skill set, right? Like his political intelligence is he seems to be good at never putting himself, to your point, in those truly zero or one situations where it's just obviously just bad. As much as, you know, he says the famous, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue point, he wouldn't actually just walk up and shoot someone on Fifth Avenue.
He would have had a good reason.
There would have been a, you know, I had Mark Leibovich on a few weeks ago, and he, you know, he made this point that he would do it in a stand your ground state. The person would have jostled him beforehand. You would have looked into the person's background, and like would have turned out they'd posted about, you know, January 6th, like 6 months ago. Obviously, that would be this basic scenario there. So I guess what I'm really hearing here from you, and I think this is why I think your prediction of polarization is going to come true, is that the nature of Trump is that despite everything, he's not actually a cartoon villain where he's going to just say, no, I want the nuclear codes. I'm going to put them in a box in the corner of my house and then not give them back. Almost certainly, that is not what's happening here. And frankly, if that was what's happening here, this raid probably would have happened a year ago, to be frank, in terms of like the way I tend to think through these situations. Now, I'm pro the raid. I think from my perspective, the fact that he didn't just give the boxes back placed the Justice Department in an incredibly difficult position. And my basic point is, look, if he didn't give them back, as has been all but basically just confirmed at this point, what was the possible alternative? But that also, to your point, though, everything I'm saying fits into the polarized situation where Trump is going to excel in, at least for now. Like, what's your response to that, maybe?
Well, I'm not so sure, I guess, factually, you know, he claims that he was cooperating and had given things back. I'm not sure we exactly know. There's clearly some dispute. A subpoena was issued. You can, you know, I think the step short of the raid legally that you could have done is, you know, filed an injunction in court to order him to comply with the subpoena. And then everyone would see sort of what's going on, and the legal process would go on without a surprise raid. And, you know, there would be news that, you know, the Justice Department wants these back and is filing an injunction. So I still think that there may have been intermediate legal steps, and that, and I'm not sure to what extent he, but yeah, you're pro raid. I mean, you're also calling it a raid. Some people only call it a search. But what was the other question on the facts? I'm just not totally sure. I think it's true, you know, and my instincts are anti-raid, but I think it is true that, you know, people have messed around with classified documents and then played games with the government. The government's not always very nice about it when it handles it. So I, you know, that has to be acknowledged. But I'm still not convinced it was necessary or appropriate. But I think Trump, you know, and yeah, and again, we'll see. I mean, was he, you know, I hate to put down these sort of markers because the goalposts are going to move, but was he just having these documents because he thought they were his letters with Kim Jong-un, his his mementos of correspondence with foreign leaders, or was he going to abuse the material in some way? To me, that's sort of the flag I would plant, just like my January 6th goalpost I would put is, was he coordinating with the violent people, or was he just giving the speech and kind of reckless about the results? I don't think that has ever been shown. So to me, January 6th is a not prosecutable offense for Trump. And same for the documents, as far as I'm concerned.
I guess what I'm curious about then is, do you have any concerns that we've found ourselves in a situation, given the polarization you're describing, where Trump is just effectively above the law? Like, what's your response to that pushback? Someone could basically say, everything you're saying, Jason, is fair, it's well-reasoned. If we take a step back, though, and look at the underlying dynamics you're describing, we found ourselves in a disastrous situation where there's just no way to see Trump ever truly actually being able to be punished or checked in any different ways. Like, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's become the term above the law. And I mean, first I would just say, you know, we like saying nobody's above the law. That's not really true, because while you are president, you in fact can pardon anybody convicted of any federal crime. And that's totally unreviewable. It's just you're totally unfettered authority. That certainly seems above the law. If you're president, there's, you know, executive privilege that prevents you from complying with various legal processes. In Congress, if you're speaking on the congressional floor, and you libel somebody, you can't be sued for that because you have congressional immunity. Diplomats have a certain kind of immunity. So, you know, it is true that the way that our government operates by necessity, and this, you know, things like parliamentary immunity go back to, you know, hundreds of years old in Great Britain. So the way that our democracy has been set up, there's some ways in which, yes, certain people are immune for certain acts. Trump is no longer president, so we're going to have this whole dispute about, did he declassify? Would it matter if he declassified? How could he have declassified? But I think, you know, so I would just, sounds very nice to say no one's above the law. Not totally true in terms of actual government operations. As for Trump, the problem is he's, you know, he's in a position where, you know, if he, let me see, how do I put this? The law involves, you know, a balancing of interests. And so you have to decide, is it in the public interest to prosecute Trump for something? And I take the point, you can't have just a heckler's veto. Well, people are going to do a riot if we don't enforce this law, or if we do enforce this law, therefore we're going to basically do something different. You know, we have had that in our history, you know, and sometimes, and maybe that was a bad thing. For example, Robert E. Lee was indicted in Virginia, and ultimately the Johnson administration, Grant, convinced them to not prosecute him because the idea was,
this is after the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah. This is after the Civil War. Cause you know, the idea for national comedy, you know, we shouldn't do it today. And perhaps rightly, I haven't studied it enough. People think, well, that's a mistake. You know, the South should have been prosecuted. The leaders of, should have been prosecuted as opposed to this attempt. And, you know, that's a very different example. I don't think that, that today's example is anything like that, but that's just an example of how, you have to, you know, there's some element of weighing the national interest that goes into this too.
You know, something I'm curious about, given what you're saying here, because I think it's important to note that this is happening, to your point in the piece, at a time when the country is in the midst of institutional breakdown and collapsing trust breakdown during a time of polarization. So all that said, something you often hear from folks who are pro-prosecution is, you see in Israel, you see in France, in plenty of Western democracies, former elected officials being severely punished, real jail time, real consequences, those bits. So they say a world where these prosecutions could happen is not inherently banana republic-esque. It's not inherently third world. It's a normal practice in Western democracy. I agree with that point. But it seems to be what you are saying is that in this specific moment, Trump himself presents difficulties that make it difficult to just say, well, in France, they do this, in Israel, they do this. What are we going to do? So what would you say then the American standard for thinking of, let's say, political leaders who lead tribes during fractious moments? What's your framework? There was a framework clearly for the post-Civil War period. What's your framework for right now? And this could apply to Democrats and Republicans too. So like not just about Trump, how would you say people should think about this?
Well, it's really interesting that you bring up France and Israel, and I think that's a good point. And I don't want to be taken to mean that there's no circumstance in which a party leader can be or should be prosecuted. What's interesting in Israel, you know, of course, is we'll see how successful it is. The prosecution sort of began, and then in multiple elections, Netanyahu continued to cling to power. He had struggled to form a government, but he, you know, remained prime minister for, you know, several election cycles in close succession, and is now running again while his trial is ongoing. And I would say, I haven't checked the polls recently, but it may be a favorite to win again in the fall in Israel.
But there was Ehud Barak though, right? So it's not just
sure.
Ehud
Barak, and I think one more, and you're absolutely right. And of course, in Israel, you know, it's such a small country that if you're on top of that power pyramid for long enough, you know, it's apparently hard to not have broken some rule in your transactions with somebody or somebody else, because it's so small. I think, you know, and you're right about France. And of course, in the United States, unlike in some other countries, we have no bar on running for office while you're in jail. Even Eugene Debs, who was prosecuted under the Espionage Act by the Wilson administration, won a lot of votes from jail the 19-teens. So, and, you know, Trump, despite what Mark Elias says, could not be disqualified, even if he's convicted of a crime. The qualifications are in the Constitution. You can't disqualify someone. So I think, but I think you're right to point that out. I think the U.S. is a little bit different in that, you know, we're a big, diverse, continental republic. We have less consensus around what is beyond the pale because, in some sense, because we're so big and diverse. So, but I don't think... I don't think that it's something that could never happen. And I think, anyway, I forget where you were, what you said with your question. What's my framework?
Yeah. I'll give my quick critique of what happened then to sort of set up your framework point. So I think Republican politicians, their initial response being any raid, any search equals banana republic third world. I think that's a huge screw up. That is a disastrous framework. There is a way to critique what happened that basically doesn't just set the bar. At that point, basically, that's a bar where you're never really going to see that guy attack the FBI outpost. Because if you say that this is a banana republic, third world authoritarian move, any type of raid, any type of search, because that's what happened. They knew no details. It was just sort of like, there's a raid. That's it. Like we're done. We're going to defund the FBI. There are certain people a little younger than us who literally tweeted, I want fans to search this person out, just to, I don't know, take note of this, because I think this is just like disgusting, frankly. Tweeted, you know, when we come back into power in 2025, Trump coming back into power, every single person associated with this raid is going to prison. I think that is the definition of like a terrible framework. And it really sucks that Tim Scott, who was asked about this during his book tour, just got in trouble for saying, hey, like, let's just like wait and see. So how do you just advise people? I guess to say specifically on the right, because this is going to be a problem the right has to deal with now over the left. I'll just say comfortably, people would be more than willing to, I think, throw Hunter Biden to the lions at this point. You see a lot of Democrats being like, we don't give a shit about Hunter Biden. So you assume it's not going to have a constitutional crisis over that. How would you advise the right, like, I hate to sound gatekeepy, but responsibly discuss this issue?
Let me first just one more thing that I should have mentioned in my last response is that we have this pseudo criminal proceeding that is designed for people, for elected officials, which is impeachment, which is designed to sort of recognize that there's a political consensus element involved here, and that you can't just have, you know, that you need to win buy-in from both parties in order to bar somebody from office. And that was impeachment. And I think there's a really smart post that I keep pointing people to by this Ohio state law professor named Ned Foley, where he pointed out Mitch McConnell, when he was voting to acquit Trump of impeachment, he said, that's okay. You know, I'm acquitting him because the normal criminal process is still available. That's a total abdication. And that's has it backwards. You know, if you want somebody, if you think that, you know, what they did is so bad that it should be exposed to the criminal process, you should be voting to impeach them, which is short of that, not just leaving it to the criminal process. So I think that, you know, and that, and the fact that we can't, you know, and the fact that Trump was acquitted tells you what you need to know about whether there would be consensus of a political prosecution being undertaken by Merrick Garland's Justice Department. It just wouldn't happen. So how, I mean, I think it's fair, Marshall, for Republicans like Glenn Youngkin, you know, to say, you know, Garland's Justice Department went after parents at school board meetings. This is a politicized Justice Department. I mean, because there's a certain element of like, there are some things that people will talk about immediately after they happen, and other things where there will suddenly be like, oh, I have to wait and see. I'm reserving judgment. It's like, well, you don't reserve judgment when it's something that's politically convenient for you. So the fact that, you know, you're a politician and you're now reserving judgment, that itself is making a judgment of a kind. So I think it's fine. And I, you know, if I was a Republican politician, I would probably say I'm very concerned about this. This must have, you know, and there's varying degrees of it. I certainly there's varying degrees of it. But I think, like I said, because the fact of the matter is we're in a tribal world where one party is going to support this and another party isn't. I think if you're a Republican, you're going to be skeptical of this raid.
I guess the question then is, I'll just ask it directly. What do you think of the right critique that the country is trending towards an undemocratic banana republic? And this is where the democracy as a framework is important. The right wing version of this critique is that we are losing our democracy. Their version of it is we're not living in a democracy right now because you have an unelected deep state capable of implementing its will over that of the people. That is the downfall of democracy. Once again, to your point at the start of the episode, this is why the more we push on the why can't we all just agree about democracy, it basically doesn't last past first contact with the enemy, because you very clearly get a huge disagreement. But sorry, right. Go on.
No, I think, and I mean, on your democracy point, I think, and this goes back to your first question, that I think that when people talk about democracy, they're mean the Republican and Trump is a threat to democracy. It takes, I think, if you study, and I think, you know, in many ways, it makes more sense to look at Latin American countries in comparison to the US than European countries. You know, an influential book on this front was by Levitsky and Ziblatt, Why Democracies Die. And it was basically trying to argue that the Republicans are a singular threat to democracy. But because they, you know, declare their opponents illegitimate, they do this, that, they shatter norms, they do this, that, and the other, they play hardball and escalate. It's like, but you're doing all the same thing. You're saying that your opponent is totally beyond the pale. And so I think it's a cycle but it takes both sides for this process to happen. I think that's what rubs a lot of people the wrong way about the democracy rhetoric, is that this suggestion that their side is clean and the other side is the problem. I think in this case, you know, it's certainly fair to worry about abuses of the security service and abuses of the Justice Department. And we saw it happen with respect to Trump before during the Russiagate scandal. But the fact is, we're just not there yet. We have courts and we have political accountability. Republicans are about to win an election and give the Justice Department a hard time for this in hearings. And, you know, it's still out there in the open. But I think people are right to worry about this process where one side gets into power and uses the Justice Department against its opposition. I mean, Trump has said he wants to do this. I think, you know, Merrick Garland has politicized the Justice Department in certain ways. And so I think it's something to worry about. But, you know, it doesn't mean the end of democracy. I mean, before Watergate, the Justice Department was used, you know, was used in these totally abusive ways on a regular basis, or the FBI was. And you know, it's, but it's, it is something to rightfully worry about.
I want to, once again, like you're an analyst here, so I'm not pushing you morally on this, but I think a critic of you would say, when you describe both, it takes two sides to tango here, like that's whataboutism, you know, all those different bits. And I want to push you on this angle in good faith, which is say, look, obviously in 2000 and 2004, you had Democratic members of the House object to the election results in both cases. You had rhetoric about how the Supreme Court wasn't legitimate, George W. Bush is an illegitimate president, all those different bits. That being said, like the entire Democratic Party did not organize itself around Al Gore making those claims. And it's hard to see the Democratic Party having its own version. This is probably going to tick people off, but it's just hard to see a Democratic version of January 6th, even in today's environment. But if you want to push back on that, please do. So I just basically want to hear, like, what are beyond outliers, right? What are Democrats doing that you think are the equivalent of, let's say, Carrie Lake in Arizona, Mastriano in Pennsylvania, all those different bits? Like, what's the equivalency?
Well, I would just say, you mentioned 2000 and 2004. I think that goes to my point about how this does, in fact, happen in a cycle where, you know, there were small signs that the Electoral Count Act wasn't working, with three times Democrats objecting to the election of a Republican president.
You've covered this issue. Can you explain the Electoral Count Act and like this, the thing?
Sure. So maybe this is going too far in the past, but after the disputed election of 1876, you know, Congress tried to create a mechanism for resolving disputed elections, which basically kicks it to Congress to decide which slates of electors to count if the states are disputed. In fact, in this case, no states were disputed, but Trump tried to gin up, congressional objections anyway to not count the votes of states that he lost. And, you know, Democrats tried this getting varying numbers of congressmen to go along in 2000, 2004, 2016. I think, you know, the way that Republicans at least see the Russiagate inquiry as sort of an illegitimate effort to drive Trump from office or thwart his priorities, really based on not a whole lot of actual substance for 2 years, you know, is a real thing. And then I think the riots over the summer, over that long COVID summer, you know, these kinds of things, I'm not saying obviously that they excused right-wing riots, but I mean, that's just how you see mobs form. You know, when you have political violence, it grows on all sides. And I think, And I would push back that you couldn't imagine a right-wing or a left-wing version of January 6th, because, of course, people have pointed out that, you know, shops were boarded up in Washington, D.C. in case Trump won. You know, that the worry is that there would be riots if Trump won, especially if he won without winning the popular vote, I would say. And,
But the quick thing there is, even, and I guess this is what the core of the debate comes down to, riots after someone wins is different than an attempt to, at the final finish line, change the result. So I agree with you that because I was in DC at the time, the post-November riots could have been disastrous, and it's very reasonable to expect that. That being said, there's a difference between those riots at their worst and what I think the worst actors on January 6th actively seeking to force a change in the result. Do you know what I mean? So what I'm saying is, someone punching out a CVS's window at a, let's say, threat to democracy level is not quite the same thing, unless you could argue, I don't think you could argue, that an elector in, let's say, Pennsylvania, let's say Trump wins Pennsylvania, would say, okay, shoot, I better split my vote, I better change my vote and ignore the actual results, because rioters are going to show up in Pennsylvania and burn my town down. Like, that wasn't what was happening. So that'd be my point.
I agree. There's nothing like that we've seen in the last few years, like the riot at the Capitol and President Trump. And as you said, President Trump taking the side of the people who wanted to overturn the election, as opposed to like John Kerry or Al Gore before him, just in Al Gore's case,
shutting up and disappearing. Al Gore right. saying I lost, and then John Kerry just right. going back to the
That's
Senate.
Certainly different. This certainly, look, but I think that the way it works is mutual escalation. So I would not rule that out in the future is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I think what we saw with the Supreme Court this year by the Democrats and their affiliated groups was quite scary. I mean, there was you had a leak of an opinion, which was a norm-shattering effort to interfere with the judicial process, apparently. You had these protests outside the justices' homes, which are violate federal law that wasn't enforced against
Can you explain the federal law a bit? This is very contested.
Yeah.
Well, Controversial is a better way to put it.
I think it's, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's been tested in court, the constitutionality of this law, but there is a law that says you can't show up at the house of a judge or juror with the intent to influence a particular case that they're deciding. And, you know, I think most people would agree that, like, if there's a local trial and there's a bunch of guys who, like, show up there to intimidate the judge outside his house, I mean, you know, this is something, anyway, it was not enforced, right? Nobody was arrested until somebody tried.
Quick question. And this is where, once again, like, you don't have to have a perfect answer, but I think it gets to, I hope this episode's theme is basically like, don't throw around the term democracy like it's a panacea, because it'd be very straightforward for a protester there to say, Jason, I'm just participating in my democracy. I'm not threatening anyone. I'm saying these are my rights to choose. So it's just interesting how, like, in every single one of these topics, you and I could both, depending on which side we pick, find a democracy justifies this basic version. So sorry, but go on in terms of until there was an actual threat.
Exactly right. Well, nobody was arrested. And then somebody, you know, did show up predictably, right? Totally predictably. If you have mobs around, as there was on January 6th, bad people show up to exploit that situation. Apparently, had weapons outside of Brett Kavanaugh's house and has been charged with attempted murder. And then, you know, at the same time, the backdrop of this is you have people in Congress promising to try to overturn the court, you know, basically with court packing, which again is not, which is legally allowed. But I don't think that there was a whole lot of respect.
And it's kind of democratic.
And it's very democratic. Well, guess what? It's also democratic for the House to, the elected members of the House of Representatives to throw out an election. I mean, it's I joke to people, right? Because the House is the more democratic branch, and which was the branch it was the less democratic branch, the Senate, in which only 10 senators or 9 senators voted to overturn the result compared to like 137 in the House. That's another way in which, you know, you have this irony where in this more democracy is always better theory, the Senate would therefore be bad, but the Senate wanted to affirm the election results more than the House because those senators were not up for re-election for 4 or 6 years and weren't as worried about what their constituents would say if they voted to go along with the transfer of power. So I think that's one of those. But I think what we saw with the Supreme Court is bad. And just going back to the Electoral Count Act, it's now being reformed so that now appeals are channeled through the Supreme Court instead of to Congress. That's a simplistic way of putting what the reformers of the Electoral Count Act in this proposed bill with Susan Collins and Joe Manchin are trying to do. They're trying to put things into the court. How do you think that people are going to respond if the Supreme Court, you know, 6-3 affirms a call by Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania that Trump or DeSantis, in fact, won Pennsylvania? I mean, ultimately, it's like you have this reservoir of legitimacy where you need someone to decide. And it's like, well, we can put it in Congress. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, well, we'll put it in the court. How have the Democrats been talking about the court lately when it rules against them? You know, we'll see. It's but it's not so simple a matter as saying that we want a democratic outcome.
I guess the question for you then is, this is a particularly depressing episode, not your fault, but also as the topic is not let's get jazzed about the realignment and fix everything and make everything hunky-dory. What is the way through? in this political moment, right? So I'm thinking, I'm doing a lot of like Winston Churchill reading now. And, you know, Churchill goes to his son at some point during the early part of the war. And he's like, I think I see a way through. I see a way through to victory over Nazi Germany. And his version of the way through would be the United States entering the war. And that's the way that that goes about. What do you say? I don't see you as a like doomer. Oh, like the country is doomed. We're going to have a civil war, like buddy, 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 blah. What is the, I'm confident despite the difficult dynamics we're describing here, version through that you see?
Well, I don't have a policy fix like reform the Supreme Court ethics code or add, have gerrymandering commissions or something. I don't think the solution is procedural. I think our processes are fine. I think that our constitutional processes are pretty good. I think we just need, it's going to be the people who are filling out those institutions need to do a better job. And I think, you know, exercise. I said in this column that you asked me about, that I think this decision over Trump, it's not a matter of everyone follows the law, you know, like we just put it into a computer and it spits out what the law is, or we apply legal inputs and it gives us legal outputs. And you know, it's mechanistic like that. It's not, nor is it, you know, I don't think the answer is to politicize the law and for each side to get more and more retributive when it gets in power. I think you need to show some statesmanship. And you need to show, you know, some good judgment, which is not something that you just learn from law school or Twitter law. It's, it's going
to
require that people, you know, Twitter law is a whole thing. but it's something that you don't learn that. You have to have show the kind of statesmanship. And we've just not had great leadership. And, you know, if we're going to nominate Trump and Biden again, you know, it just shows you how we're not getting particularly impressive statesmen up there. But I think that's ultimately, I think that's the only way that we're going to, I think you need two things. You need good leadership. We may not have like the kind of 80% or 90% consensus that we used to get, but at least getting like 60% consensus. I mean, that's the thing, people who say, we're becoming an autocracy. No, we have really close elections. We have incredibly, the House and the Senate are flipping back at a historic rate. In the 20th century, you'd go like 50 years with one party controlling the House. Now it's like every midterm. We have very competitive elections and nobody gets a big majority. So I think, you know, part of it's going to be, and I think good leadership, I think Americans would respond to good leadership by delivering it a bigger majority. And then we would get out of this doom loop that I described, where like no matter what happens, everyone is in their corner. You'd still have 30% in the corner, but you'd have a big enough consensus around something that you know, we would have a politically conclusive answer sometimes. It wouldn't just be totally hopeless.
Man, I want to just add something to what you're saying, because we've disagreed a bit on this episode, but I'd like to like get to a point of total agreement. I like your word statesmanship at the level of Biden and Trump, but there's a level below that. And what I basically described to you, what I described, my version of saying what you're saying here is, we're living in a hyper-politicized moment, and something that government bureaucrats, NGO types, folks who came up in the very technocratic 80s and 90s and most of the 2000s just don't understand is that a decent portion of their job is actually navigating the annoying aspects of politics. And it's not actually doing your job to say that doesn't matter. So I got in this like huge fight with my parents. I think this was November 2021, because it was Thanksgiving. I was back in Oregon and they were talking about like, man, like, do you see this clip on Twitter? Like Dr. Fauci just totally owns Rand Paul. Like he sets him up and he like back talks and he's like, well, actually, body, 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 body. And I was like, Mom, Dad, that's a disaster. That is actually not good. Because A, if you understand the issue of COVID, you understand that at a core level, COVID's a hyper-polarized issue and you don't want an issue like COVID to polarize. So when Dr. Fauci goes and testifies and he fights openly with the senator, A, the senator wants that to happen. And that's good for Rand Paul. And B, it actually just demonstrates the fact that, like, you, when you are participating in these spaces, if they are polarized, you are a political actor. You are not capable of just being like a technocrat who's implementing things and telling them how they are. So for me, it's not even just like statesmanship that's required at the mid to lower levels. It's actually just understanding that, hey, in an ideal world, let's just say you're talking to a center left person. In an ideal world, we could be the wise men implementing the policies that we want, this, 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 or that. But what's difficult about this moment is that nothing we do cannot be seen outside of politics. And saying, I ignore politics in my decisions, that's actually not an act of supreme greatness. It's actually an act of, frankly, I think, immaturity and unwillingness to reckon with the world as it is. You can go different directions. So you could say to yourself, look, I think that what Trump has done at Mar-a-Lago is so bad that I'm going to take whatever the consequences are. That's a valid thing. But to act as if those consequences don't matter, I think that is the definition of someone who I would not appoint to a position of any responsibility in this moment. To your point, the law is about balancing. You have to be able to balance those factors today.
Yeah, no, I think, and I argue with my friends on the right who are like, Merrick Garland is so political and bitter, and you know, he must be trying to get back at Trump over and Republicans over the Supreme Court. It's like, no, I don't think that that's what's going on at all. As somebody who is worried and skeptical and about this raid, I don't think that that's how Merrick Garland's brain works. I think he totally thinks that he's apolitical, right? He thinks he's extremely, he thinks that you can have this technocratic approach, but then that leads him to not realize that what he's doing is political, and that distorts his judgment. I mean, it's like you said, like, look at how all of our public health experts, Fauci, think that they're apolitical. I mean, hardly. It hasn't turned out that way. Whatever they think, and I'm sure that Dr. Fauci is not, does not actively consciously think of him. But that's the irony, is that in order to have like an impartial, effective, apolitical rule of law, civil service administration, things like that, military, etc., you actually do need some level of political judgment, at least to be in the mix there, because the pure technocracy route is not going to save you as an alternative.
So we'll close here, because I think I've done a lot of coverage of the gerrymandering, first past the post, all those different issues. And to your point, I would be a lot less skeptical of the like ameliorative effects of those reforms if we just didn't see such a gap when it comes to performance. So I would be much more concerned about the structural nature of the country if you had a set of leaders who understood the dynamics you're describing and then performed them effectively. I think what we're really just experiencing is there's a gap at a performance level between this world that's being birthed now and the standards for success in the 90s and in the 80s, right? Like, you and I were, we're 29, 30. There are things that we are going to learn and that our cohorts are going to learn in this political moment, they're going to be disastrous in the 2070s. And I really just think that like neoliberal technocracy, I'm not saying that in terms of like economics, I just mean like the generic, what does a good civil servant look like in the 1990s who like, let's say, went to Harvard and, like watches NPR and is just like generically good at their job. The processes that made them successful, I think, for a period of their lives are going to be very difficult for the next decade or so. So let's just close on this point then. What would you say would be your number one piece of advice then for people in the Biden administration who are just going to have to escalating cases? Actually, no, let me reframe it. Two pieces of advice I would like for you. One, what would be your advice for Republican politicians? Let's say Tim Scott on one hand saying, let's wait and see. And then Josh Hawley, the other end saying banana republic. What is your advice for navigating these situations for them? And then what is your advice for, let's say, Merrick Garland's Democrats who have to make these judgment calls?
Well, I'll start with the Merrick Garland, because I think it's a little bit easier. I mean, I think that he should hire different people. I mean, in my sense, he's been a federal judge. He's known as very deliberative and cautious, but I get the sense that the people in the levels beneath him are that, frankly, the same thing that we've seen in all of our institutions, Marshall, in universities, in media companies, and so on. I think you have, you know, the younger generation versus the older principal. And I think you see that in the Biden administration, whether it's Yellen or Garland or, you know, the president himself or Klain, or to some extent, I think, you know, you have this element of how is the old liberal guard, these like 20th century liberals who believe in all these liberal principles, how do they reckon with the rising generation? Is it going to be a smooth shift or is it going to be a big disjuncture? You know, when do they decide, okay, what it means to be a liberal has changed, and when do they put their foot down? So I think, you know, there's got to be, to some extent, different people there. So it's less of an insulated group that's below Merrick Garland. I think that I would tell him to stop leaking. I mean, if you're going to say that you're going to you're going to do everything by the book and just do everything and no one's above the law and everything's by the book, it's like, well, then why are you leaking all the details of this case? That totally discredits that approach, even if you take it on its own terms. There's a bunch of, you know, political things that I think that they've done. You know, the school board thing is an example. I think they're doing some things in terms of like the other cops in the Floyd case. I think they're prosecuting too aggressively some of these other police that were there, you know, because I think it's, you know, they see it as, you know, this is a really important thing to hold accountable everybody, but it's like, okay, but would you treat all police in this way? So I think that they've got a political lean to them, like all justice departments do to some extent, but I think, you know, I would hope that he would rein that in. And that starts with, I think, you know, and so anyway, that's the best I can do for Merrick Garland on the question of these,
both ends of the right. The wait and see right. And the way I'll put it is the too cute right. I think it's too cute and a little too 4D chess to play with fire the way people are playing with fire right now, is my take basically. And I think if Democrats were more effective, they would have an easier time of actually making that be an actual consequence for folks.
Yeah, I think that the wait and see right, besides Tim Scott, is mostly in the sort of press. I mean, I think most Republicans have put out, you know, Glenn Youngkin is seen as sort of a more moderate figure than DeSantis. And his statement, if anything, was, I think, just as aggressive. I think, you know, and I think in politics and when you're talking, it's fine to, you know, politicians say lots of things, but I think what really matters is what they're going to do when they're in power. And
can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
Let me pose a difficult question then. To what degree? So like, obviously there's the January 6th there in Ohio who suicided by FBI cop, copped himself, like attacked the field station, was killed, posted on Truth Social, but this is war, all these different bits. To what degree, if at all, are Republican politicians who rhetorically raise the stakes? And once again, there's obviously like a left-wing version of this too, right? So we could ask the question of like, to what degree is someone responsible for Brett Kavanaugh? Okay, so this, let me just make it completely nonpartisan. To what degree in this environment are politicians responsible for escalatory moves by the extremes when they engage in rhetoric?
Yeah, it's such a hard, that's the ultimate sort of test of where your loyalties are. Because after one of these things like this shooting, this the guy you mentioned who was going to attack the FBI office, or the Brett Kavanaugh thing, it's always, you know, the fault of the other people, but not your own people. I think, yeah, and that's something else that just requires, I mean, a lot of people in Israel think that Netanyahu was responsible for the, you know, with his rhetoric in the 90s for the assassination of was it Sharon? And
Yitzhak Rabin.
Oh, Rabin, sorry. You know, and then, but that sort of, it's just something for the political process to sort out. You know, what the Israelis decided, that actually wasn't beyond the pale. I think it's hard to have a framework for that, because it's legitimate to object to the other side, and it's legitimate to object in strong terms, and your supporters will want you to do that. And in part, that's a substitute for violence, right? We use language and that can avoid violence. And if you refuse to use any real heated political rhetoric, then maybe, you know, you're not representing constituents enough, and the political system won't be able to contain the violence. On the other hand, you know, things that are insightful in this way, I think we know it. We disagree on the margins, but you know, I don't think that people condemning the FBI raid are responsible for this. I don't think that people saying I condemn the Supreme Court for this ruling that is wrong are responsible for the Kavanaugh situation. But I think once you start going the next level, saying go to their houses, you know, and so on, and you start then you start getting into different territory.
So what I'm hearing then is you're applying the standard for Trump in January 6th that you were talking about, which is, the question for you is, did Trump say, hey, Ashley Babbitt, go break down the glass door and like attack the Capitol? That is different than him saying going to the Capitol. I think the point that I'm hearing from you here to build on that is basically, I guess let me just sum this up then. Here's how I would sum up what you're saying. I would, and my own perspective. I would say, like, my lesson from January 6th is that in this political moment, everyone is just collectively playing with fire. So there is just a way that you could be you can just play it cute and think you're playing a deeper game, and it can really, really, really lead to disaster. And I think every politician should have that as their default mode right now. If I say something, if I engage in a specific style of rhetoric, if I tell my tribe a very specific thing, this could be risky. I think the other bit that I would really stress to folks would be this argument that, you know, man, it would be really straightforward right now maybe better articulate this. Here's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about politicians in a populist moment giving up their responsibility to set tone and actually lead people. Because I think you see a lot of folks basically saying, like, look, like, we're not in control of anything. Like, we're just another set of actors, and people are going to do what they do, and we're just following people. I think it's easy to understate during deinstitutionalizing moments and distrustful moments the power that politicians still have. So those would really be my warnings would be. Like, I really think that there are people who are seeing language about we actually live in a third world hellhole where your family is at risk. I think people see that and they take that to its logical conclusion. And people should be wary of engaging that way.
Isn't that the rhetoric? I mean, I agree. And I think that's the rhetoric, though, that the resistance sort of made under Trump. We now live in a fascist, authoritarian country. And I guess one problem with this style of debate is I think the rhetoric may be more tolerated when it's the left doing it than the right, which the right is assumed to be inherently.
It's highbrow. This is where the academic bias comes in. When this rhetoric comes from the left, it's Weimar, you know, we're on the path to red versus brown in the streets. And it's discoursed in a very simple way. When it's coming from the right, it's obviously coarser. And I think I totally accept the critique that the left is able, the MSNBC book publisher center left to left, and frankly, this is more of an issue that the center left has to confront, is much more able to launder its language in academic speak.
The right,
and the
right is assumed, you know, to be more violent and sort of like to have this latent violence. And by the way, I think, you know, it does, the right-wing violence and left-wing violence take a different form, and that has something to do with it. I mean, you know, Merrick Garland prosecuted Timothy McVeigh as part of his history. That was one of the most, probably the most, yeah, certainly now that I think of it, the most deadly, you know, terrorist attack, blowing up a preschool and everything. In
domestic, in, yeah, domestic American.
In American history. And, you know, and then, but by the same token, you know, I think left-wing violence, I mean, people still have not processed how much violence there was in the summer of 2020, how much property was destroyed, how many police were injured. It's sort of like, you know, and with as riots are ongoing, with liberal politicians sort of saying like, this is great, this is important. And so I think, you know, the double standard is really hard to navigate because one does not excuse the other, but I think it's important to remember that, you know, it's not only, when you try to make it a double standard, then, you know, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. And I think the thing I'll just close on, like, I don't know about you, but I've been really interested. We've group chatted about this before. I'm really interested in like the, like Weather Underground, like late '60s, like early '70s. And it's like really interesting. That's an example of highbrow leftist violence. Yeah. Like very, very graduate, like it's a shitty graduate school, but it's like very like grad school speak. And actually, and this actually kind of goes to your point of like, this is why like language and Twitter are important, because there's a more of a decent chance that a lot of the people who were involved in the, you know, SLA or the Weather Underground would have actually just been posters today. They would have hosted podcasts. They wouldn't have actually engaged in like revolutionary bombing, because they now have an outlet via the internet. You're able to channel these like emotions and these bits into different features. So I think that's another important way of, I think it's one, we kind of started by you noting that like the internet means that it's harder to just police these bad things. I think the existence of the internet serving as a outlet for this style of political violence and danger is actually really important. So I think that's a great way to leave it, unless you have anything you want to close on, Jason.
Nope. I don't think we've solved the problem of American large D, capital D democracy, but hopefully we've given people stuff to chew on for how to think about it and argue about it in the future.
Yeah, and I think, look, let's say that we did this. I think we accurately described a moment and specific challenges and tensions in that moment. Our shared beef with the democracy TM folks is people act as if you introduced a third or a fourth party to this, it'd be straightforward. Or, man, like the lack of first past the post voting is really stressing our system. And I'm like, no, like it's a moment and it's deeper. So, Jason, thank you so much for joining us on the realignment. I know folks are going to have lots of opinions on this. So thank you for joining to discuss a admittedly like really difficult set of topics to discuss.
Sure. I'll brace myself for the opinions. Thanks, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.